From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. David Satcher was born in 1941. His family lived in Anniston, Alabama, and there was just one black doctor in all of Anniston. And without this doctor's care, Satcher might not have lived past the age of two. So yes, that doctor saved Satcher's life and changed his life too. Of course, I'm talking about Dr. David Satcher, who went on to become director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 1993, and then in 1998, the 16th Surgeon General of the United States. And he joins us now. Dr. Satcher, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, this story of what happened to you when you were 2 years old is one of the stories you tell in your book, My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. And I was wondering if you could tell us more. Take us back to 1943. What happened to you?
Well, I was born and reared there in Anniston, and I think I was the seventh of nine children. But at any rate, I became very ill about the age of two with whooping cough. And that's my earliest memory, because if you have whooping cough, you remember struggling to breathe. And I remember that. I don't remember anything else from the age of two. All the other memories are after that, but I do remember struggling to breathe. Dr. Jackson came out to our farm to see me on his off day, and he spent all day there, according to my parents, working with me. He alerted them before he left that he didn't expect me to live, but he also... I told them what they needed to do to give me the best chance to live. And they did it, apparently, diligently, because the word I have from my sister, my older sister Lottie and others, is that my mother would stay up all night, and if I stopped breathing, she would even breathe for me. So I survived that. And then the one thing I wanted, of course, when I got old enough to learn about Dr. Jackson, I wanted to meet Dr. Jackson. And my parents promised me that for my fifth birthday, I believe, they would take me to town to meet Dr. Jackson. I was excited, looking forward to meeting him. Never met him. He died that year. So from that point on, I wanted to be a doctor like Dr. Jackson. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Satcher, forgive me for interrupting, but I just want to pause for a second and go back to something you said, that
please.
Dr. Jackson had told your parents what they needed to do to try to save your life. And I'm just seeing this image of your mother sitting at your bedside at night, even breathing for you, like kind of almost resuscitating or you if when on the moments you stopped breathing as a toddler.
I wish I could describe that for you, but okay. I can't.
Okay.
Because I don't remember it, but that's the description that's been given by my sister and others. My oldest sister, Lottie, is still alive. Mm-hmm. She's about 7 years older than I am.
Now, had you been a white family, would there have been other treatments or other options available to you at that time?
Well, I would have been in the hospital.
Yeah.
Anytime a patient gets to the point that you think that patient is going to die, the illness is that severe, then that's an indication for hospitalization, especially if it's a child. But in Anniston, the hospital did not accept blacks at that time. That was the rule. I mean, I can go on about what racism was like. I tell people one of my earliest remembrances, of course, is saving my money because I was going to buy an ice cream cone from the drugstore when I went to town with my brothers. And I did. I saved it. Ice cream was not that expensive. I think it was 5 cents. But when I went into the drugstore to get a cone of ice cream, the lady behind the counter said, you know, we don't serve. And I won't use the word that she used, but it starts with an N. Mm-hmm. She said, we don't serve you in here. You know, at the age of five, that's quite a shock. Mm. I had never heard of somebody not being served because of their race or color. But that was the beginning. Yeah. So that sort of set a pattern in terms of what I wanted to do with my life and what I wanted to change.
Yeah. You know, the reason why I'm asking for these specific stories and details is, you know, I've been thinking a lot over the past couple of months about sort of how we on this show talk about issues in America. And sometimes we use what I think is kind of sanitized language. Like, you know, when we say racial injustice, what is it that we actually mean? Well, here's an example from you, one of the preeminent physicians in the United States, who's telling us that when we say racial injustice, what we mean is that as a child, you almost died, but by virtue of being black, your family could not take you to the hospital. So racial injustice means your mother had to sit there, your family had to sit there and potentially watch her baby die. So that's what that means.
Yeah, and many children did die. I try not to forget that there were many children who died at home. They were black. They never went to the hospital. Hmm. And I'm sure that was true not only in Anniston, but a lot of other places. Yeah.
So tell me then, the story, this clearly is a power, you said, it's a powerfully inspiring story in your life that really shaped the direction that your life went. Can you tell us a little bit more about the steps that you took to head towards medical school?
Yeah, I should probably pause and say a word about my parents. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a lot of children. We had a 40-acre farm. Everything we ate, for the most part, came from that farm. And each one of us had a job. My first job was taking water to the fields for my siblings. And then, you know, as you became more skilled and larger, you got other jobs, feeding the chickens, then milking the cow. And I was very good at that, by the way. Sometimes my mother didn't even believe that I had finished until she looked at the bucket and saw how much milk I had got. But the main thing is that each one of us had a job. We appreciated each other's responsibility and our responsibility for carrying out our own.
So there's important, like your family helped shaped you without a doubt.
Yes.
And so then as you're growing up, you were born in 1941, right? It's not long after that, especially as we push into the 50s and most, without a doubt, late 50s, where the civil rights movement is taking shape around you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's a lot that I can say about the civil rights movement, but one of the things, of course, that stands out in Alabama was the bus boycott. Mm-hmm. By that time, Martin Luther King, Jr., was the pastor of a church in Montgomery, Dexter Avenue. The first member of our family to go to college, my older brother, Robert, was a student at Alabama State. And he used to talk about going to Dr. King's church and hearing him preach on Sunday. And then when the bus boycott started, everybody, all black people in Montgomery, decided they were going to walk to wherever they were going and not ride the bus. And it's, you know, the rest of that story. It was a very successful bus boycott. And my brother Robert, and I'm next to him in age, he liked to talk about Dr. King and quote Dr. King and what Dr. King said. Dr. King was a Morehouse graduate, so I decided that I wanted to go to Morehouse. And there were some doubts about whether that was going to be feasible, but it worked out. I got a scholarship and a job, so I was able to go to Morehouse College. The rest is sort of history. I did quite well there. I met Benjamin Elijah Mays, who was the president of Morehouse, and who spoke in chapel every Tuesday morning. I've never heard of another president who spoke to students every Tuesday morning or once a week, but Benjamin Mays did because he felt that part of our education was making us believe in ourselves. that are helping us to develop a commitment to excellence. And so he became a major hero of mine. Now, remember, about 10 to 12 years earlier, Martin Luther King Jr. sat in that same chapel as a student, and he heard Benjamin Mays speak. You may remember that Benjamin Mays did the eulogy at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral. But he was an amazing guy, you know, and that went all the way through my life. I mean, he spoke at my inauguration when I became president of Meharry. So he was a role model like Martin Luther King Jr. I can quote Benjamin Mays the way I quote Martin Luther King Jr. because the things they said, they lived, and they stayed with me as leaders who had a cause, who stood for something, and who shared their vision with students.
Yeah. You know, we only have about a minute to go before our first break here, Dr. Satcher, but do you have a favorite Mays quote you can give us before we have to take this first break?
Yeah, Benjamin Mays said, and I think it's in my book, "It must be borne in mind that the great tragedy of life is not in failing to reach all your goals. It's in having no goals to reach. Not failure," he said, "but low aim is sin." Low aim is sin. He did not believe in low aim.
Yeah. Well, we are talking this hour with Dr. David Satcher. His new book is My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking with Dr. David Satcher. He served as director of the CDC from 1993 to 1998. He was the 16th Surgeon General of the United States thereafter until 2002, and then also Assistant Secretary of Health as well. His book is My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. And Dr. Satcher, before the break, you offered to us that amazing quote from Benjamin Mays. I would actually like to play a little bit from Dr. King, because I understand that there's one particular quote from Dr. King that you especially love, and we have it here. This is from a speech that Dr. King gave at the Freedom Rally in Cobo Hall in Detroit of June of 1963. And here, Dr. King talks about the potential costs or the price that nonviolent civil rights activists might have to pay at the hands of segregationists.
"And even if he tries to kill you, you develop then a conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true that they're worth dying for." "And I submit to you that if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live."
Dr. Satcher, what is it about that quote that moves you so much?
Well, because I have had, on several occasions, I've had to make decisions. You know, am I going to join the student movement and go to jail when it could mean that I won't get into medical school? Which is what I had been working toward, you know, all my life since the experience with Dr. Jackson. So if you make a decision that there are some things worth dying from, that means that there are some things worth living in a certain way for that you wouldn't live otherwise. So if you decide, I'm going to challenge segregation and segregation laws, it might result in my not being accepted. And I'm sure it did in my case, because I was very competitive when I applied to medical school. And I'm sure there were some schools that didn't accept me because, you know, of that fact that I had been to jail. I mean, people don't understand necessarily nonviolence and going to jail. It was years before I think people appreciated that people went to jail because of what they believe, because of what they were willing to give up. I was willing to give up, if necessary, in my career aspirations. I'm happy that I didn't have to, because I had a lot to do in my career. But that's what Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about. Sometimes it's easier to die than it is to die for something than it is to live for it, especially if living for it means suffering and sacrificing. So that's you're right. That's my favorite Martin Luther King Jr. quote. You know, by the way, when I was a student, Martin Luther King Jr. was co-pastoring Ebenezer Baptist Church here in Atlanta. And a group of us used to walk from our campus the 5 miles over to Auburn Avenue to hear Dr. King preach. We knew the schedule, when he was going to be in town, when he was going to preach. And some of us would walk over there to hear him preach. I remember it as if it were yesterday.
Can I ask you more about that? Because, of course, yes. for many of us, we've only ever seen and heard Dr. King on video, right? Or audio recordings. We've never had the privilege of being in the same space as him as he would give these sermons and preach. Like, tell me more about what that was like, because I can only imagine that could you almost even like physically feel the power of his message as he was?
Oh, yes, definitely. It was quite an inspiration, which is why we didn't hesitate to walk. Well, it turned out to be 10 miles when you consider we walked over there and we walked back. We didn't have cars back in that time, and students do today. But I had no problems walking over there, hearing Dr. King speak, and coming back highly motivated. And that's what led us to begin the student movement. I remember when they said they were going to have a meeting to talk about it, and I went to that meeting, and key people there whose names you would recognize. Marion Wright Edelman was a sophomore at Spelman then. Otis Moss had just graduated from Morehouse College, and he was in Divinity School. Lonnie King had played a little football with Morehouse, but he had decided that he was going to devote his time to helping to desegregate Atlanta. I heard these students speak, and I decided to join the student movement. And it didn't take long before I was behind bars. And then later on, I was in prison. But the prison came when I had become a leader in the student movement. And we decided that we were going to fill the jails. And we were really able to get a lot of students from Spelman and Morehouse and Clark to join us and go to jail. And sure enough, we, the leaders, were sitting waiting to hear the results, and we ended up in a restaurant. They asked us to leave. We refused, and they told us that they were sending us to prison because we, in fact, had been successful. We had filled the jail cells with students, and now the only place they could send us was to prison. So that was my most memorable experience with getting arrested. I was going to prison. I learned a lot about prison. The work was not that hard because I grew up working on farms and fields, so I can't argue that the work that we had to do in prison was hard. It wasn't that hard for me because my parents taught us to work hard.
Dr. Satcher, quite frankly, I can't help but to be a little charmed by what you said, because you had worked hard as a child, that prison labor didn't feel hard. And yet, at the same time, of course, it's not right to have to be forced to do hard physical labor that way being behind bars for advocating for your civil rights. But I want to get back to something regarding the choices that you were making, even as you were pursuing your dream to become a physician. right? Because that's what you're talking about. Like that Dr. King said, there are things that you have to be willing to give up, to die for, essentially, in order to achieve this bigger dream for equality and justice in the United States. So, for example, I understand. Tell us a little bit more about this particular story, that in medical school that you had to, or you decided to walk out of a particular OBGYN workshop. I mean, I can't imagine that that was an easy thing to do, because you could have, I mean, been, you could have lost your space in your spot in medical school. But what happened then?
Well, on my way to medical school, you know, in Atlanta, of course, at Morehouse, as I explained, I went to jail, went to prison, never gave up on my dream, and also took my books to jail and prison with me. I studied when I got a chance. I was serious about wanting to go to medical school. Okay, so I end up in medical school, end up at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, because I didn't have the money to pay to tuition. They gave me an opportunity to work, and that work had associated with it the opportunity to pursue both the MD and the PhD. So I worked in the laboratory. I did research. Ultimately, NIH decided to fund my way through medical school because of a proposal that I sent to them for the work that I was doing. And I had a very good advisor in Neil McIntyre. But so some things happened to me that I thought were for the worst, and they were for the best. And one of them, of course, was having to work, because if it had not been for that, I wouldn't have had a PhD. You know, that was not in the plan. But because of the nature of the work that I was doing and the person I was working with, I was able to get credit toward the PhD. And in the 7 years I was there, I achieved both. And by the way, my favorite part of that is when I graduated in 1970, there in the audience, not far from the podium, were my parents, Wilma and Anna Satcher. Mm-hmm. Never been on an airplane before, but they were there.
Wow. And this... So I'm just pausing for a second, because, of course, what's flashing through my head right now is, again, that image of your mother sitting next to your bedside when you were two. And it must have meant, I mean, it could only have meant the universe to your parents to then see their very son have ascended to these heights as a MD, PhD. Wow.
Now, and I have a picture of them sitting in the audience when I was inaugurated as president of Meharry Medical College.
Yeah.
Over 10 years later.
Well, speaking of your mother, the story I was hoping you would tell, and maybe you can tell it now, is about there was an obstetrics workshop that you were participating in at one time. But you walked out of that workshop because of how Black women were being treated in the workshop. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. As a student at Case Western, I met a few people who felt the way I did about, you know, justice and treating people with dignity. Some of them were white. In fact, most of them were white, because there were not many Blacks at Case Western when I went there. And we used to go out into the community and talk with people and stuff like that. But when it came time for me to go into OBGYN training and my schedule and leave the laboratory and go in, on the first day of the rotation, and I was in a group of nine, I was the only Black student in the group. So we walked into this room where we were supposed to learn how to do the pelvic exam. And there were four Black women, and they were up in stirrups already for us to practice the pelvic exam. There were no sheets that, I guess I'd call them sheets, the things you use to protect patients, so that they have their privacy when they're participating in these training programs. And by the way, back then, Medicare and Medicaid were just starting. And so it was understood that if you couldn't pay, that you were going to be a part of the training program. It was not meant to be negative, but that was just the way it was. But what bothered me was the fact that the women were treated with disrespect. So I walked out. And I remember the faculty member who was over that rotation in OBGYN. He had been in the military. I think he had been a major. But anyway, he told me, you know, that if I walked out on his service, he would make sure that I was put out of medical school, not just his medical school, but every other medical school that I wouldn't get in. He was upset. He was obviously upset because he viewed it as a personal insult that somebody would walk out on his service. So I did. And I'll tell you later why I don't think that was necessarily the best decision. But anyway, obviously, I didn't sleep that night, and I'm sure my wife didn't either because I was married by that time. But they told me that I was to see the dean the next day. And the assumption was that, you know, the dean was the one who was going to put me out. So the next morning, I went to see him. His name was Fred Robbins. He had won the Nobel Prize for helping to develop the oral polio vaccine. So I was shaking as I went in to see him. Had never met with him before. And as I walked in the door, you know, he was smiling. I wasn't quite clear why that was, but he then said, David, I understand you got into some trouble over there yesterday. And I thought about it, and I said, yeah, I guess I did. And I explained to him how I felt. He said, well, do you know what happened this morning? I said, no, I don't. He said, this morning, the other students all walked out too. And they said that they agreed with you, that it was disrespectful to treat the women the way they were being treated. And the nurses agreed with you.
So, Dr. Satcher, given that it sounds like your one act inspired others to do the right thing as well, you said earlier that you thought it might not have been the best decision. Tell me why.
Yeah. Well, in the book, and I didn't know I was going to say this until I was in the middle of that story. If I, as a leader, even though I didn't know these students because this was our first day of rotation together. One thing I could have done was to stop and talk with the other students and to say, look, this is inhumane. We shouldn't do this. And there may have been some of them who would agree with me, and therefore I wouldn't have put myself at the same level of risk. And as you know, the next morning, they got together, and I wish I could tell you that I knew the names of all those students, but I don't. But they got together and decided that if it was inhumane for me to do it, it was inhumane for them to do it. And they walked out. And that the nurses were especially involved, and I say this because later they raised money to establish the Satcher clerkship that allowed Black students to come to Case Western for 2 months or 3 months. And of course, it benefited the school greatly because they ended up recruiting more Black faculty from that than they ever had. Mm-hmm. But the reason I said that maybe it was not the best decision is that I could have been put out of school, but the fact of the matter is that I was not. But is it a chance that I had to take, or could I have achieved the same thing? And so in the book, I raised the possibility that I could have stopped and talked with the other students. I don't know what they would have done, but since they made that decision themselves, it's highly likely that they would agree. So I just, talking to future leaders, sometimes the leadership team is broader than you think. And sometimes you can influence people to act in a way that you may not have thought you could. Does that make sense?
It does, actually. Yeah. And it really does. And at the same time, though, at that moment, you didn't know, which is why these lessons that you learned and sharing with us retrospectively are incredibly powerful. So we're talking this hour with Dr. David Satcher. His book is My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. We have a lot more to talk about regarding health disparities, the pandemic. When we come back, this is On Point.
did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we've been listening to Dr. David Satcher. Yes, the former director of the CDC, the 16th Surgeon General of the United States, former Assistant Secretary of Health as well, and founding director and senior advisor at the Satcher Health Leadership Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine. His book is My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. Now, Dr. Satcher, I'm wondering if you could just listen along with me, because you know, this pursuit, this quest for health equity, obviously, is still ongoing in the United States, and I think we have all been re-reminded about how urgent that quest is, reminded again by the pandemic. And so, we actually spoke with a physician in Philadelphia, Dr. Ayla Stanford. She's a pediatric surgeon in Philadelphia, and at the beginning of the pandemic, Dr. Stanford started hearing from her Black friends that they weren't able to get coronavirus tests. And then she discovered this.
Drexel University put out a paper that said there were 6 times more testing sites in affluent white neighborhoods than there were in Black neighborhoods. And I, you know, beside myself and just said, okay, so I need people who need a test, testing kits, and a location to test them.
So she acted. Dr. Stanford contacted fellow physicians and got COVID tests from them that were not being used because their clinics had been closed due to the pandemic. She rented a van, and then she went out into the community. And that is how the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium was born.
The first day we tested, April 16th, 2020, my husband drove the van, and we drove to people's homes who had registered on my work website that they needed a coronavirus test. That took way too much time driving. And I ultimately convinced LabCorp that if they could provide the test, that we would find the need. In the beginning, folks waited like 3 to 5 hours for a test. There was this older gentleman, probably 75, and he had been at one of our testing sites. And he said he had to leave. He was a funeral director, and he was getting called all the time to go pick up bodies from the hospital. So he left. And then he went to another testing site in his location. And at 75, and being someone who picks up dead bodies that are primarily Black and from COVID, he showed up at this one location. And because he didn't have a referral from his doctor, they would not test him. And he left and then came back to see us. And he talked about how hard it was, you know, picking up bodies and not allowing family members to grieve. And then at the same time, being concerned about his own health because he couldn't get tested. And he's 75. So what makes, you know, a healthcare entity turn away a 75-year-old man who picks up dead bodies? Like, who does that? What's funny to me are the children. You know, adults are like, oh, that thing's going in my brain. It's going to hurt. It's the worst thing ever. And kids usually giggle and they say it tickles. I love that. So then we had this other group that was like 75 to 85 year old people who knew they didn't have COVID at all. It just came in the car because they wanted to see. Like, some of them had never seen a Black doctor. We got also lots of older folks saying, I'm so proud of you, baby. I'm so proud of you. I had one prominent healthcare system in Philadelphia reach out to me and say, listen, you know, you already have this relationship with the Black church. How about we bring our van with all of our testing kits and our personnel, and you have your setup, and we will test everybody with insurance, and you can test everyone without insurance, and that way everyone can get tested. I thought to myself, do you even hear what you're saying? The dichotomy already exists between the have and the have-nots. We don't need to, you know, exacerbate it by demonstrating on our site, if you have health insurance, you go to this pretty fancy location, and if you don't, you come over here. I see the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium being the Black Doctors Consortium and removing the COVID-19 out of it, and being a health advocacy center, we can work on changing all these health disparities and health inequity, work on breast cancer and rates and colon cancer, disproportionate rates, and so many others, and have a coalition of doctors who are there only because they want to help you change that narrative that statistically, as a Black woman, you're more likely to die from breast cancer than a white woman. Like, I'm so tired of hearing that. I've heard that for over two decades since I've been a physician for 23 years. And I'm telling you, on April 3rd, when I heard once again that African Americans were being diagnosed and dying at a rate greater than other people, I was like, I'm not gonna sit and just listen to this. I heard this when I was in medical school 20 years ago. And now I can do something about it. Everything the community needed, I had, and just made it work.
That's Dr. Ayla Stanford, founder of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium. Dr. Stanford is now the physician of record for more than 15,000 coronavirus tests in Philadelphia. Well, Dr. David Satcher, I think what Dr. Stanford is doing in Philadelphia is one of the examples of the kind of leadership that's trying to narrow health disparities in the midst of this pandemic, right? But much of that leadership has been taking place at the local level because of a lack of clear leadership at the highest levels. So let me for a moment lean on your experience as former CDC director. I mean, can you just talk about a little bit about what you have seen regarding the nation's response to the pandemic, and how, I mean, do you think that that response has contributed to the disparities that we've seen regarding COVID?
First, let me say that I have been very concerned about CDC's response, and I've written about it along with some other former directors of the CDC. Obviously, I don't believe that any of us served as directors with the president like President Trump, because I think, you know, when I approached President Clinton about apologizing for the Tuskegee study, he didn't even hesitate. He said, this is something we need to do, David, I agree. And we did it. And so it does matter who's president when you're director of the CDC. We should make that very clear. Everybody who works under President Trump has an added burden, I think. And it's hard for me to explain that added burden, because it's beyond, you know, if you can go beyond racism, it's beyond racism. It's a person in the highest office in the country who behaves in some ways that are very immature. I could use some more negative terms. So I think the CDC has been a real part of the problem, if you will, during this pandemic. Because it's not been reliable in terms of a consistent message. And that goes for testing, that goes for treatment. And you have a president who basically has argued with the scientists in terms of what should be done and the meaning of different things. So I just think we ought to be upfront about that. The CDC today is not dealing with the kind of Washington that I dealt with. I mean, I could talk about what I did, but some of the things I did, I wouldn't have been able to do. I remember when we were caught up in how can we get children immunized against disease, childhood diseases, including whooping cough and others. And one barrier was there were so many kids who couldn't pay. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get President Clinton and Donna Shalala to agree that there should be no financial barriers to children being immunized. And they supported that, and Congress supported it. And so back in 1997, 98, we got the immunization levels for all children up into the mid to high 80 percentiles. But it was with support of people like the president and the secretary. And I'm not sure, well, I am sure that that kind of support does not exist today, unfortunately.
Well, the you're right to mention that while you were CDC director, the work that went into raising vaccination rates was significant, and like you said, from 50% to the above 80%, a really major advancement in the public health of the United States. And in fact, that and you. There's a couple of threads here that you actually tied together for me. So vaccination, you mentioned that you had gone to President Clinton in the late 90s, in the second half of the 90s, to talk about the need, I mean, the moral need for the United States to apologize for the decades of the Tuskegee experiments. And I just want to play the moment where President Clinton did indeed publicly apologize for that. This is in 1997.
What was done cannot be undone. But we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
So that was President Clinton in 1997 apologizing for the fact that for decades, doctors in the United States experimented on black men in particular. But this idea of the lack of trust that many black Americans have in the healthcare system.
Yes.
Which in part emerges from things like Tuskegee. We actually had an On Point listener call us to talk about that a little bit and how that's playing out here in the midst of the COVID pandemic. So this is Beverly from Watertown, Massachusetts, who called us to talk a little bit about her experience as an African American woman in healthcare.
People have been talking about the reluctance that some black folks may have in taking the vaccine for coronavirus. Oftentimes, they cite the Tuskegee experiment as a reason. I just want to say that for black people, any and every encounter that we have with the healthcare system can be negative and potentially damaging. We deal with condescension and nastiness from providers. We receive a different level of care sometimes. For example, we may not be given a particular treatment because the doctor assumes that we would not be smart enough to comply with the instructions.
So that's Beverly, an On Point listener in Watertown, Massachusetts. Dr. Satcher, the reason why I wanted to bring those threads together is because this goes to the heart of one of the things you've been working on for your entire career. I mean, we still have a ways to go before these disparities are eliminated. But what needs to be done in order to create a world where black Americans can have the kind of treatment they deserve and the trust needed, especially in the midst of a pandemic where we have hopefully some vaccines coming that people should take?
Yeah, I've been involved in working on the development of the vaccines. And one of the most interesting things, of course, is that we were concerned about the participation of blacks and Latinos in the trials. And it turned out that the participation was much higher than anybody expected. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of reasons even today for there to be hesitancy and doubt. But I also think that there are indications that for many blacks, they're not going to let anything stand in the way of being involved in something like a vaccine trial. Many of the people who are speaking out against vaccines, by the way, are not blacks,
right,
and they're not poor. They are part of a movement to speak out against immunization. I'm sure you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Started out at Disney or somewhere, but. So I think we still have a long ways to go. I'm sitting here looking at a photo in my office, and it's a photo of the night before President Clinton apologized. There are five men sitting in wheelchairs, and behind them, in addition to President Clinton, is Vice President Gore and myself. We're going to have dinner with them, and then the next day is the apology. There were six of them who came to Washington because we wanted them, those who survived, wanted them to be there. But I think one of them was gone to the restroom. So there are only five in the photo. But I know there were six survivors there when the apology was made. And we sent people to Tuskegee to be there with those who couldn't travel so they would know how important this day was. Now, remember, there were over 400 black men who participated in the Tuskegee study thinking they were being treated for syphilis when they were being studied. And on that day, when the apology took place, eight of them remained alive. That means 392, if my math is still with me, were deceased. And, I don't know what all of the causes of death were, but I will always remember that day. And I even see a photo of the person who spoke for the survivors of the Tuskegee study. Mr. Shaw was his name. And I have a photo of him shaking hands with President Clinton.
Well, that's a moment that wouldn't have been possible without the work of my guest today, Dr. David Satcher. Dr. Satcher's new book is My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. Dr. Satcher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been very nice being with you.
This is On Point.